following podcast is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. So, kids shouldn't be listening. Elton says fuck and shit a lot, sometimes fucking shit, but rarely does he advocate actually fucking shit. You get it? Enjoy the show.
Quote, "Everything I do, writing, touring, traveling, it all comes from the punk and hardcore attitude, from that expression, from being open to try things but relying on yourself, taking what you have into battle and making of it what you will, hoping you can figure it all out as you go and make some sense of it." Unquote. Here's another quote from the author. Quote, "If I said it, I must own it. If I was insensitive at the time, got something wrong, etc., I'm willing to bet that I've corrected myself going forward. I take criticism pretty well. I know I can always learn and improve. Amending something to me is inserting wiggle room where you don't deserve to." Unquote. End quote. You know. Henry Rollins said that June 29th, 2017, in an interview by Paul Samel. And one more quote here. Quote, "I've been trying to figure out why I go around and do this. I really dig this writer, Henry Miller, and in his book, The Air-Conditioned Nightmare, there's this line, I'm paraphrasing, quote, we don't talk to one another these days. We bludgeon each other with facts and figures gleaned from cursory glances at magazines, unquote. Very rarely does someone try to communicate, and that's what turned me on to this kind of thing, unquote. Henry Rollins from the LA Times in an interview published in June 14th, 1987. That's Henry Rollins for you. Tonight, or day, or afternoon, or whatever, ladies and gentlemen, we will delve into that life and the work, well, or one work. Works? One of the works. Or definitely the one book. One book of his. One book he worked on, that he wrote. Actually, that he compiled of things that he wrote. Yeah. The book is called Before the Chop 3. The author is Henry Rollins. He's the guy. He's the guy that wrote the books, the compiled. God damn it.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Welcome to Elton Reads Book a Week, the podcast's only internet to safely web the information and books. My name is Elton and I read a book a week. This time around, the book is Before the Chop by Henry Rollins, the third book in his series of poetry collections dedicated to coping with his circumcision and the loss of his foreskin, quote, shorn from his life, unquote. As he would say, at the tender age of 1 month old. The first book in the series, called simply Before the Chop, was 213 pages of mixed prose dedicated to the subject. One piece written for each day from his birth to the, quote, severing of his innocence, unquote. The second book is an abstract take on the perceived effect of the circumcision on his emotional development from birth to the, quote, event of separation, unquote. Employing both a stream-of-consciousness method a la Jack Kerouac and the, quote, transcription of cacophony, unquote, method of poetry writing. It's a process wherein Henry Rollins watched 361 hours of medical films of circumcisions and attempted to both transcribe them and his feelings at the same time, in real time. It's pretty powerful stuff. Today's episode is about the third installment in that series titled Before the Chop 3. It explores the same theme, of course, only now from the perspective of all that might have been had he not been subjected to the circumcision at 1 month old, as a 1 month old infant, going on to firmly place the blame for his, quote, penile holocaust, unquote, firmly on his parents' shoulders. He skews them for quote, subjecting him to a misery he never asked for, unquote. Henry explores the incredible life-altering pivot his entire worldview took at the most formative and impactful age of 1 month old. The pages pulse with anguish and sorrowful regret at the loss of himself, or more to the point, his foreskin. Some of the titles of the poems included in the volume are The Tip Is Gone, What of My Soul? Another one is Mommy, Why the Cutty My Pee-Pee? And Ruminations on the Length That Never Was. A quote from the Village Voice said, quote, because of the blunt force power of Henry Rollins' words, I'll never look at my penis without crying. Ever. Ever again. Holy shit. My God, what if any of that were true? Can you imagine anyone sane, writing at length about being circumcised at 1 month old? I mean, someone other than me, just a few seconds ago. I faked all that. Can you imagine them stretching it? That's a lot of wordplay happening there. Can you imagine someone stretching it to 3 volumes? That's insane. Yet, I propose just that. And you're right. It would be insane. You should probably turn this podcast off, boil your phone to sterilize it, and then throw it away. Please don't, though. Your phone's expensive, and there's a lot more of this episode ahead. I'm sorry about all that, but there really is a series of books called Before the Chop. That's true. And this is the third one. That's also true. But, I mean, come on. Tell me that title is not begging for a dick joke or a guillotine joke or guillotine? You know what I mean. Head choppy thing. Tell me there's not a dick joke or a guillotine joke. Something about dicks. Or maybe not about dicks. Let's go innocent. Maybe a chopping vegetable kind of thing. Like a chopping broccoli, a la Dana Carvey. Chopping broccoli. The SNL skit. You know what I mean. Go look it up. Dana Carvey, chopping broccoli. I think he still does that fucking bit. It's ridiculous. Anyway, I'm an idiot. The actual really real book is called Before the Chop 3. That's, you know, like I said, it's true. It's a collection of columns written by Henry Rollins for LA Weekly from 2014 to 2016. His work for the LA Weekly was typically in the form of columns and articles. It allowed him to share his thoughts and observations on a variety of subjects, further establishing his reputation as a writer and cultural commentator. Why would anyone pay him to write whatever the hell he felt like? What makes his voice, his ideas, his viewpoints so goddamn special? Let's find out, shall we? It was a cold February 13th, 1961, in the middle of a snowstorm, that Henry Lawrence Garfield was birthed into the world. That and in just one short month, he would turn into a bitter, pain-filled world of circumcision-related hell, courtesy of his unfeeling parents. Or not that at all, and just a snowstorm. Well, there was a snowstorm on the day he was born. And his name was Henry Lawrence Garfield. Okay, the place where he was born was Washington, D.C. His parents, Iris and Paul Garfield, were, by Henry's description, alcoholic, ambitious overachievers. I'm paraphrasing, of course. His father was a World War II veteran, a teacher and economist with a PhD in economics. Economics? Words. His mother worked for the Department of Education. So, nerds. When he was very young, around 3 or so, his parents divorced. Henry would later say that he never knew why. In an interview from the Sydney Morning Herald, he said, "Once I was out of diapers, I spent weekdays with Mom and weekends with Dad." Oh, I almost fucked that up again. I've been doing it a lot. Henry would abhor both of the places, moms and dads. He would abhor both of those places, walking on eggshells until one outburst or another, you know. He goes on to say, quote, "When my parents split, Mom hit the ground running. She was a motivated young professional working in education. I was a totally hyper child. She didn't know what to do. She didn't have friends who were parents. They would come over for gin and tonics, cigarettes, and to bitch about Nixon. Her peer group was motivated feminist types who had boyfriends but weren't looking to get married. They didn't live off men. The separation was very unfriendly. When I was 9, Mom would make me tell Dad if he was late with his child payments. I didn't like it when she made me do that." Unquote. Iris remarried several times, exposing young Henry to a series of boyfriends and stepfathers. This tumultuous family life had a profound impact on his formative years, and without a doubt his feelings toward her and his father. Henry has described his childhood after his parents' divorce as a blur of chaos and instability. During a recent spoken word performance I went to, he said something like, "My parents were both overachievers, and having a kid was the last thing they wanted. And then, you know, he came along." He would say that some people just weren't equipped to raise a kid. These two were not. Raised primarily by his mother, her boyfriends, and stepfathers, he felt he didn't have a stable home life. One incident I came across really cut to the quick of what he was talking about. It's alarming and involves a sexual assault as a child, so if you want to skip ahead, I get it. Seriously. I wouldn't want to trigger something, you know, unwelcome or anything like that. From the Sydney Herald interview, Henry said, quote, "I was sexually assaulted at the age of 7 by Mom's boyfriend. He was a mean drunk and perverted. I wasn't penetrated, but it was a game changer. I'd done something wrong, and Mom got him to come over and straighten me out. He came in like a hitman and beat the hell out of me with a belt. He made me strip down naked, then played with me for a minute. Mom was in the living room. It made me very angry. I've never raised my voice or a hand to a female, but I will hit a guy without thinking twice. Thankfully, I'm able to curb that anger, but I feel it all the time." Unquote. God damn. Fucking dirtbag shitheads like that. Doing that shit to kids is just, ugh. Just fucking gross. He also struggled with bullying and low self-esteem. Rollins describes his childhood as terribly unhappy. One of his mother's boyfriends also beat him, too, and mentally abused him. I'm not sure if it was the same guy, the fucking gross motherfucker from earlier, but still, that's what happened. Despite his mother having taught him how to read before he was enrolled in kindergarten, Henry was prone to bad grades, bad attitude, and poor conduct. I'm no psychologist, but I would imagine it was because of his mother also flying into spontaneous drunken rages that constantly stressed him out, and his father and stepmother being roughly doing the same. Soon, Henry would find himself enrolled at the Bullis School. Back then, it was an all-male preparatory school in Potomac, Maryland. Quote, "It was brutal," Rollins says. "Why did I go? I had problems in school. I was a hyperactive bad student. Couldn't concentrate. Got horrible grades all the way through school, except English. Over 100 average in English. Loved it." Unquote. End quote. Fuck, I gotta get that right. But the school's tightly structured atmosphere, together with the unstable situation at home, didn't do Henry any favors. He did credit the Bullis School for helping him to develop a sense of discipline and a strong work ethic. It was at Bullis that he began writing. His early literary efforts were mainly short stories about blowing up his school and murdering all the teachers. Fucked up. In an essay titled Iron and the Soul that appeared in Details magazine, Rollins characterized his life there at the Bullis School, writing, quote, "The humiliation of teachers calling me garbage can and telling me that I'd be mowing lawns for a living, and the very real terror of my fellow students, I was skinny and clumsy, and when others would tease me, I didn't run home crying, wondering why. I knew all too well why. I was there to be antagonized. Unquote. So to recap, his home life was a stress-filled tornado of alcoholism-shaped shit. School life wasn't the greatest, and growing up in Glover Park, a middle to upper middle class neighborhood in northwestern Washington, you would think maybe someplace like that would yield some kind of forgiveness, you know, against all this bullshit building up so far. But according to Henry, quote, it was a very rough upbringing in a lot of other ways. I accumulated a lot of rage by the time I was 17 or 18. One can only imagine. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. First, he meets a very, very good friend. It was also around this time that Henry would meet a lifelong friend that they still talk. I guess they still talk on a regular basis. Well, up until today, I guess. I'm pretty sure. I don't know. We don't hang out, you know. But chances are they do still talk once a week, or have, and they have been for the last 40 or 50 years. Ian MacKay and Rollins became friends when they were about 11 or 12. Quote, there was a stir about this kid down the street who had a BB gun. And that was Henry, said Ian MacKay. He had a BB gun, and he had some snakes and a Cheech and Chong record. When I first met him, I thought he was a bookworm, which he was. But he did have this BB gun, so we would go to his house and shoot poker chips in the basement. Unquote. Skinny, insecure, hyperactive, and taking prescription Ritalin since leaving preschool, wow, to his senior year of high school to calm his body and mind, Henry would later learn that he was a part of a drug test group for hyperactivity run by the National Research Center. Quote, I was an extraordinarily weird little kid. Not in cool ways. Hysterical, hyperactive, thrown out of school for being a disturbance. It was a mental condition. I wasn't trying to be bad. I was completely out of control. Imagine you rip the tea bag open and just put the tea in the water and all the bits of ground up tea leaves are floating around. You stir it up and it's like this storm of tea leaf chunks, right? You can't see through it. Then the water finally calms down and all the tea leaves are at the bottom and the water is clear. Without the Ritalin, I was stirred up tea. I didn't get along well with other kids. I'd eventually just attack them. You look at me, I run at you screaming. Or I'm in the corner crying. I was just a wreck. I feel so bad for my parents. I must have been just hell. You couldn't take me anywhere. But when you put on music, the hyperventilating stopped. The crying stopped. Ah. There was nothing my parents could do to calm me down like the records could. Unquote. Right around the 9th or 10th grade, he would secretly stop taking the Ritalin, while at the same time started lifting weights after being inspired to do so by a teacher. Hormonal, pumping iron, and way, way off his ADHD meds. By 13 or 14, Henry was at war with most of the neighborhood kids, including Ian MacKay. Quote, there was a lot of time spent walking up Wisconsin Avenue and seeing Henry and then, you know, and then running and hiding, says Ian MacKay. But then all of us started skateboarding. And it just so happened that Henry was also skateboarding. Henry and I ended up spending every waking moment together. We became great friends then. Unquote. We really bonded over skateboarding. We had this gang of kids, and we decided to form a team, so we just formed our own skateboard team, even though we had no sponsor. It was more like a street gang for us, unquote. He would continue, it was a tribe thing. I think I deeply desired a tribe, and the skateboarding thing gave me really good practice on how to define the world around you. Then, what I got from punk, was a sense of a call for self-definition. that you can make your life what you want it to be, that you didn't need someone else's approval, and maybe even that you needed somebody's disapproval. Henry Rollins attended American University in Washington, D.C. for one semester after finishing high school. However, he chose to drop out in December 1979. Following this, he took on various minimum wage jobs, one of which involved being a courier for liver samples at the National Institute of Health. It was during this time that Rollins discovered punk rock, thanks to acquiring a copy of the Ramones' self-titled debut album with his friend, Ian MacKaye. Rollins described this experience as eye-opening. He said to ABC News in Australia, quote, "For me, punk rock was finding out that my life had a soundtrack. I realized that my ship had come in, that I had a tribe, that I had backup. I was like 17 or 18 when I discovered that music. I've never recovered from that initial whack. I came from this minimum wage working world, so I got into all of this via punk rock from basically a guy who used to park your car or clean up after your animal. So I have nothing to lose," unquote. I feel like I have to jump in here for the sake of covering bases, you know? What is punk rock? I heard no one ask. Well, Mr. or Mrs. No One, let me try to explain it. Punk as a movement, perhaps appropriately, defies definition. There you have it, folks. Moving on. No, I'm kidding. No. Actually, the history of punk rock is a curious thing. Makes one man weep, makes another man sing. Can change a hawk to a little white dove. More than a feeling. That's the power of punk. Or, those are lyrics from the song Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News that I appropriated for some fucking reason or another. All right, I'm stopping. Punk or punk rock does have a curious history and a life altogether. See, it doesn't have an agreed-to start or definitive end, yet we're pretty sure it happened, and it died. But it's still around today. For a little change of pace, here's a different kind of fella to give you a brief history of punk rock. He's the lead singer of the band Taint Diddler. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Ironside.
Ho, how kind. Thanks, wanks a lot. It's a pleasure to do whatever the fuck this is.
Well, that's
I'm ever
not
so
necessary.
Grateful, etc., etc., and such and so forth, yeah? Now, move over and let me do what I do best, yeah? Fucking shit up like a proper villain. Growl. In the late 1970s, a rebellious spirit began to stir within the music world. People were tired of fucking about with arena rock, cock knockers prancing around like poofs in their tight trousers. Mainstream rock was shite, and fuckers wanted authenticity. This was when punk rock was shut out the mouth of mouthy cunts, who could give a rat's ass what you thought about anything. In the bleeding heart of the US death trap that is New York City, bands like the Ramones, Blondie, and Television started banging out stripped-down, take-no-fucking-shits music that beat the living shit out of the eardrums of the weak, spineless pussies and told them to fuck right off, and yeah? Punk was more about stomping the life out of coddled, soft, limp cocks and delicate virgin quims. It was an I-don't-have-to-take-your-shit attitude jammed through an amplifier at 3 chords a second. It told the quiet masses that even they, the ignored, the ugly, the jaded, disillusioned children of assholes, that they could make music too. And it could be stupid, loud, ugly, mean, and fucking scream if they wanted it to. Unfortunately, the rest of the world wanted in, and punk rock spread across the United States like a surly, prickly, fuck you, you know? Generally speaking. It would, eventually, plug its grime-covered bell end into the plum, fat-filled ass of the United States, home of the rich and fake, California. That Lifestyles of the Rich and Soulless Ass Factory quickly became a hotbed for a new kind of punk, as I faster, louder, and punch you in the fucking dick so hard it comes out of your stupid, dumb face kind of punk, otherwise known today as hardcore. Bands like the Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, and the Circle Jerks led the charge of hardcore punk, which they did, all while embracing a DIY ethos, because no one was doing fuck all to help further what all the straights thought, was the savaging of their innocent baby boys and girls' brains. Well, fuck them! They took it upon themselves to noisily smack those weakling twits and turn them into right vicious bastards and bitches. Pardon my fucking French. They recorded their own music, put on their own shows, and manufactured or paid to make their own bloody records. It wasn't about making money. It was about giving the finger to every cunt that said, you can't, or you shouldn't. The scene that developed from that was a tight-knit confederation where everyone contributed to the furtherment of the music and ethos. Iconic venues like the Whiskey A Go-Go, which frequently presented acts like The Germs, The Runaways and X, and also early performances by The Ramones, The Dictators, The Misfits, became safe havens and testing grounds for punk and its variants. Alongside the Roxy and CBGBs in New York, they would become battlegrounds for punk bands as well. Places to unleash their frustrated fury for both them and their fans. Meanwhile, fanzines like Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll served as the underground printed media, spreading the word about new bands, shows and ideas. Saz Punk's vitriolic "Eat my ass, you dumb asshole" ideology dictated from its inception. It continued to evolve, while splintering into subgenres like post-punk, new wave and alternative. Whatever the fuck that means. Alternative to what? Silence? Fuck yourself. Some bands like the Misfits and Bad Religion would keep the hardcore punk flame alive after a lot of the founding artists fell by the wayside. And still more bands and artists of the scene would break off to explore new sonic territories, a lot of which were ridiculed for doing shit like selling out, whatever the fuck that means. Punk was no longer a monolithic movement, shocking the system of the bloated corporate muse-ack shit heap. Instead, it had diverse voices now, some of which were pretty good, most of which were absolute shit. By the late 1980s and early 90s, the punk rock of ye good old days of yore had for the most part dried up and fucked itself straight into oblivion's dustbin. Almost nothing was left of it, save for the spiky-haired carcass left to rot on the floor of relevancy, long ago having been absent-mindedly swept off the plate of mouth-breathing, brain-dead Western music consumerism. Still, bands like The Offspring, Green Day and Rancid took up the mantle, and with their brand of diluted, piss-tinged swill, affectionately called punk by people who know fuck all about punk, and used it to break through to a wider audience. A lot, seemingly too simple-minded to track down better music. Through their hard work, or lack thereof, they succeeded in bringing a watered-down, sing-along, low-rent bubblegum punk to MTV and kid-friendly radio airwaves across the world. God fucking help us all. Punk fashion also became trendy around that time as well, helping to cause the misshapen mockery of a punk scene to expand. However, with that successful commercialization came controversy. Punk purists accused bands of selling out, and the spirit of rebellion began to wane, as if somehow it hadn't already had the bleeding life stomped out of it back when The Clash signed to CB-fucking-S back in 70-fucking-7. The rotted underground roots of punk felt threatened, because by now, people holding on to that long-dead flame walled themselves behind rose-coloured nostalgia. They lounged there, feeling free to judge a new audience for not being what they never really were, all while also feeling free to yearn for the decayed, long-dead spirit of punk that, honestly, was as dead as an Egyptian mummy being tossed up into the whirring blades of an industrial fan in a factory that made cheap dildos for no one. Commercialization, by now, had dug its blood-covered corporate claws into the zombified arse of punk and decided it was in greed's best interest to suck out any profitable sustenance that might remain in it. Long live punk! Trademark, copyright, patent applied, patent pending. Pick up yours today. Operators are standing by. Look, I suppose when the corporate monsters start prancing about willing to slap punk rock around anywhere, they find somebody breathing is a testament to punk's enduring influence. But honestly, a cash grab is a fucking cash grab, yeah? Today, punk rock lives on in a myriad of forms. It's an attitude, it bloody isn't, it's a style, the fuck it is. It's a cultural force, my whole puckered asshole. Wankers. Bands like NoFX, Pennywise and Bad Religion still tour, despite needing tanks of oxygen on hand and erectile dysfunction pills nearby to give the granny groupies a thrill. I will say that those bands do, at times, inspire new generations, Or at least the trite snippets of their hits do. When tweens figure out that music with a fast-playing guitar gives them a fitting background noise after they discover how to make angry faces into their phones for TikToks. For now, punk rock's legacy endures, reminding us that sometimes a three-chord song, a scream of defiance, and a willingness to cut your own path can change the world. That is, until they turn it all into an edgy mini-series, cast with former Disney Channel actors for some bloody streaming service that needs to save its flagging subscriber numbers.
Well, that was kind of a brief history of punk, or something said very British by a punk, or something with punk in it, and British. Thanks for helping out, Andrew.
A minor correction, sir. Wanken, fuckstick. Professionally, I now use the nom de plume, Anodized Irons. I feel it gives my stage persona a more Germanic, industrialized feel, which is more in line with my band's sound.
It's such a weird coincidence. I go by Anodized Irons is a shitheel. The third. It's German, I think.
That wasn't
moving on.
For.
So, between 1979 and 1980, Rollins had fully gone over to the punk side, though he hadn't quite crossed the threshold of carving his own path into it. He worked as a roadie, schlepping gear to and from gigs for local bands in the Washington, D.C. area, including the Teen Idles, spelled I-D-L-E-S. It was a punk band started by his bestest friend, Ian MacKay, when their lead singer, Nathan Strejcek, S-T-R-E-J-C-E-K, wild name, when he failed to show up for a few practice sessions, Rollins convinced the band to let him take on the role of lead vocalist. So it begins. News of Rollins' talent started to spread throughout the punk rock community in Washington, and he even had the opportunity to perform on stage with Bad Brains singer HR. The Extorts, a punk band from Washington, experienced the departure of their frontman, Lyle Pressler, who joined Minor Threat, which is another band started by Ian MacKay after the breakup of the Teen Idles in 1980. The remaining members of the Extorts, formed a new band called the State of Alert. Not called the State of Alert, just called State of Alert, or SOA for short. With Henry Rollins taking on the role of frontman and vocalist, Rollins contributed lyrics to the band's original five songs, seriously, just five, and went on to write several more. SOA recorded their only EP titled No Policy, which was released in 1981 through Discord Records, which is a record label started by, you guessed it, Ian MacKay. The record label he still owns and operates today, but that's in the future. Back in the past, SOA hit the skids and disbanded after a brief run of just 12 concerts and the release of their EP. Rollins had come to embrace his position as the band's frontman and gained a reputation for not taking shit ever, often engaging in fights during their shows. So, yeah. Reflecting on this period, he stated, it was like 19... Reflecting on this period, he stated, quote, I was like 19 and a young man full of steam, loved to get in the dust-ups, unquote. Meanwhile, Rollins had taken on the role of manager at the Georgetown Häagen-Dazs ice cream store, seriously, which, as everyone knows, is the place to get into a few motherfucking dust-ups. You want to deliver a bloodied up beatdown and follow it up with a smooth, rich, creamy ice cream? Think Häagen-Dazs ice cream. In fact, I didn't know this until this episode, but the original Häagen-Dazs slogan is as follows. Come to get your fucking ass stomped, motherfucker. Leave with less teeth than you fucking came with. Also, be sure to try our Dazzler Sundays. My favorite is the Rocky Road Dazzler because it's amazing. And fuck you, Häagen-Dazs. Made like no other, motherfucker. Well, there goes my chance at a future sponsorship by Häagen-Dazs.
Well, that's something. I've never seen someone crap the bed using ice cream before.
Oh, you should have seen me in my lactose intolerance heyday. There were a lot of surprises, if you catch my drift.
Oh, boy.
That went to a place it never, ever should have gone. No, of course, that's not the Haagen-Dazs. Ugh, lactose intolerance. It's not the Haagen-Dazs slogan. No. The job did provide Henry with a stable income that had helped him finance the production of SOAZP and keep himself afloat after the band's breakup. Plus, by his own account, and I'm inclined to believe him, he was a damn good manager at the Haagen-Dazs store, which still exists, by the way, those stores. I seriously have to hit one up. Those Dazzler Sundays, which are real, by the way, might just have me literally shit the bed after having one, though. Though it'll be a tasty way to get there.
That hole you dug wasn't deep enough, huh?
I can't help it. Lactose intolerance is horse shit. TMI. I'm moving on now. In 1980, Rollins and McKay, the recording listening besties, were in the sweet honeymoon period of punk rock discovery when they were introduced to Black Flag's Nervous Breakdown EP by a friend. Rollins quickly became a fan of the band and started corresponding with bassist Chuck Dukowski via letters. Later, Rollins invited the band to stay at his parents' house during their East Coast tour in December 1980. When Black Flag returned to the East Coast in 1981, Rollins made it a point to attend as many of their concerts as possible. During one spontaneous show at a New York bar, Rollins was given the opportunity by Black Flag vocalist Dez Cadena. Fuck it, that's what it is to me now. He was given the opportunity to sing Clocked In, the song Clocked In, as Rollins had a long 5-hour drive back to Washington, D.C. to open up the Haagen-Dazs to beat the shit out of some customers. Or he had to get to work after the performance. Same difference. Rollins was unaware of Cadena's desire to transition to guitar instead of being the singer. And while the band was actively... And that the band was actively looking for a new vocalist. Upon witnessing Henry Rollins's impressive scream yell singing abilities and pissed off stage presence, the band extended an offer to him to join as their permanent vocalist slash audience ass beater, following a semi-formal audition at Tucasa Studio in New York City. Rollins accepted the offer, despite initial hesitation. Still, he joined, partly due to the encouragement from Ian McKay. His abundant energy and intense personality aligned perfectly with the band's style. Fast, hardcore, unforgiving punk. Additionally, Rollins' eclectic taste in music played a significant role in his selection as the singer, as Black Flag's founder, Greg Ginn, sought someone who was willing to explore beyond the confines of simple three-chord punk. After joining Black Flag in 1981, Rollins decided to leave his job at Haagen-Dazs because after putting most of the customer base in the fucking hospital, there wasn't much left to do. Try a fucking Dazzler. Haagen-Dazs, made like no other. Motherfucker. I'm kidding. He did leave, though, and sold his car to relocate to a city known for its love of fun, sun, violence, and ice cream. Los Angeles, California. Upon his arrival in L.A., Rollins opted to permanently mark himself by getting the Black Flag logo tattooed on his left bicep. Additionally, he made the deliberate decision to change his surname from Garfield to Rollins. There's never been a completely clear story as to why Henry changed his name, and a couple of reasons why he chose Rollins. That's still murky, too. Some sources say that it was to distance himself from his dickhead father. Another story I've seen or found, read about, you know, in a couple of places, that also includes one of the origins of the name Rollins, is that upon joining Black Flag, they told him to give himself a little slippery distance and room to wiggle by changing his name. Because within 24 hours, the LAPD is going to open a file on you, is what he was told. And which, according to Henry, they did. He chose the name Rollins because it was the name of the college Ian McKay's older sister, Susanna, was going to. So it was kind of an inside joke for Ian McKay or something. That's the story I've seen the most. So that's the one I'm going with. Another story involves him and Mackay coming up with different names in case they were busted for shit or something like that. I haven't found much about that one, though I'm willing to bet it's probably a mix of all of that. Regardless, now named Henry Rollins, for all time seared into the annals of music history. He now found himself in a completely different environment in Los Angeles, one where the local police quickly identified him as a member of Black Flag, resulting in constant harassment. Reflecting on his experience, Rollins later expressed, quote, "That really scared me. It freaked me out that an adult would do that. My little eyes were open big time," unquote. I'll get into more detail about this in Henry's history in a future episode. I have his book, Get in the Van, that covers a lot of this period. I'll skim through it here because, you know, I'm here. But we'll get into it then in more depth. You know, you understand what I'm saying.
Elton, I've just had a long talk with the companies, all of them. And seriously, they're demanding an ad break right here, right now. Look, I'm on your side, all right? I went to bat for you. I argued for a different ad spot at a different time. But they said no. No, Elton, you know what that means. And I know what that means. It means when they say no, you say yes. Take an ad break lest their wrath be invoked, Elton. Lest their wrath be invoked.
Before a gig, while the remaining band members tune their instruments, Rollins would stalk around on stage clad solely in black shorts, clenching and grinding his teeth. You know, to meditate. Then, to center himself before the show, he would exert pressure on a billiard ball, which is a little weird, but sure. Nonetheless, his stage presence left a lasting impression on numerous reviewers. Following a 1982 concert in Anacortes, Washington, Calvin Johnson, a critic from Sub Pop, remarked, quote, "Henry was incredible, pacing back and forth, lunging, lurching, growling. It was all real. The most intense emotional experiences I've ever seen," unquote. By 1983, Rollins' stage persona had begun to create a growing sense of alienation between him and the rest of the Black Flag band members. This was further exacerbated during a performance in England when Rollins physically assaulted a member of the audience. Turns out that being the most hardcore member of a hardcore punk band just wasn't the thing to be, I guess. Henry was just, he was just too Haagen-Dazs for them. It's a tale as old as time. I just can't let that go. Sorry. No. Subsequently, Greg Ginn, Black Flag's guitar player and primary songwriter, reprimanded Rollins, referring to him as a macho asshole. Additionally, a legal dispute with Unicorn Records resulted in a delay of further Black Flag releases until 1984. And furthermore, Ginn deliberately slowed down the band's tempo in order to maintain their innovative edge. So, in August of 1983, guitarist Dez Cadena departed from the band, leading to a deadlock between Chuck Dukowski, the band's bass player, and Ginn. Ginn desired Dukowski's departure, which eventually culminated in Ginn dismissing Dukowski outright. The album released during that time in 1984 was titled My War, and it showcased heavy metal music influences, with Rollins frequently employing intense screaming and wailing throughout the songs. Notably, the band members also grew their hair as a deliberate tactic to confuse their hardcore punk audience. A quick note about hardcore punk. It was, and is, a fast, shouted version of punk rock that Black Flag and their contemporaries helped to create and shape. It's still around today and has influenced countless artists from then to the present day. Now, back to your regularly scheduled confusion. Prior to the disbandment of Black Flag in August of 1986, Rollins had also embarked on a solo career. In 1987, he released two solo albums of spoken word performances. Hot Animal Machine. And he had a collaborative thing with, he made an album that is just wild. It's called Henrietta Collins and the Wife-Beating Child Haters. It's under that moniker. I can't remember what the title is. Anyway, additionally, Rollins released his second spoken word album called Big Ugly Mouth in the same year. And then, Henry formed a new group called, weirdly enough, the Rollins Band, named after Jerome Rollins, famed Louisiana saucier, who has been celebrated the world over for his bourbon-infused dishes, known for his catchphrase, "Put some mo' bourbon in that shit." Henry Rollins was inspired to name his band after the cook after catching an interview on a late-night talk show. Completely blitzed, Jerome answered every question simply with the word bourbon before peeing himself and falling asleep on camera. And then they cut to commercial. You can find clips of it on YouTube.
Good Lord, you're just dancing your way into lawsuits beyond your ken, aren't you?
I think they would have to involve real people first. Beyond your ken.
You have no idea what ken means, do you?
I'm moving on now. No. Of course, he named the band after himself, obviously, folks. Come on now. Though, I would like to sample a sauce made by that guy I just made up. No, he formed the band with the former members of Greg Ginn's side project called Gone. Andrew Wise and Sim Kane. Oh, my word. In addition to Haskett. Another guy, you know. The band toured extensively in their debut album, Lifetime, which was swiftly followed by the release of outtakes and live recordings in the form of Do It, another album. The band continued to tour throughout 1988 and 89 and saw the release of another Rollins Band album called Hard Volume and another live album called Turned On and a spoken word release called Live at McCabe's followed in 1990. Also in 1990, Rollins and Weiss dropped an EP called Fast Food for Thought under their side project called Wartime. You can find the whole album on YouTube, and it is fucking wild. I'll try to put a link in the description, but if I forget to, then just look it up on the internets, as one does. It's interesting because it has a sound that kind of reminds you of Weiss's stuff that he would do with Ween, rather than anything the Rollins Band does. The music was heavy and has this trippy weirdness to it. I'm sure I would appreciate it more if I were high. It's been a long, long time since I got high on the marijuana. Anyway, still, the last track where they covered Franklin's Tower by the Grateful Dead. It's insane. At first, they just credited the album to Wartime, but later on, they added featuring Henry Rollins to the cover because, well, it featured Henry Rollins, big-time former sing-screamer of Black Flag. Drop that motherfucking name for that fucking fame, bitch. In 1991, the Rollins Band scored a sweet deal with Imago Records and performed at Lollapalooza, the festival, and not something else named Lollapalooza. You know, one of those other things. These moves definitely boosted the band's presence, no doubt about it. But things took a dark turn in December of that same year. Rollins and his best friend, Joe Cole, were confronted by two armed robbers right outside Rollins' apartment. This is a quick summary from Wikipedia. It was easy just to dump it from Wikipedia, so forgive me for using Wikipedia. Quote, they had attended a Hole concert at the Whiskey O'Gogo and were returning home after having stopped at an all-night grocery store. Two armed men, described as black and in their 20s, approached them demanding money. Angry that Rollins and Cole only had $50 between them, the gunmen ordered the two men to go inside their house for more cash. Rollins entered at gunpoint. However, Cole was killed outside after being shot in the face at close range, while Rollins escaped out the back door and alerted police. The murder is still unsolved. Unquote. The cops, however, initially thought Rollins might be involved in the murder and held him for a grueling 10 hours. Jesus. It was a total nightmare for Rollins. He poured his heart out about it in his book called Now Watch Him Die. Despite the trauma, Rollins didn't let it stop him from putting out new stuff. In 1992, he dropped a spoken word album called Human Butt on his own record label, which is named 21361. And that's not all, folks. The Rollins Band also released The End of Silence, which became Rollins' first album to make it into the charts. And I believe that is the first one I ever bought. I'm pretty sure. Maybe. Or was it? Wait. Anyway. I had both. I did. I do own it. Anyway. Means nothing. The very next year, Rollins dropped his spoken word album called The Boxed Life. The Rollins Band then went on tour, called The End of Silence Tour. Towards the end of the tour, they kicked out their bassist and brought in a jazz bassist named Melvin Gibbs, which is pretty badass for hard rock, heavy rock, not quite metal outfit. According to this critic, Steve Huey, 1994 was like Rollins' big breakout year or something. They even played at Woodstock 94, you know, the one that didn't end in fire, rape, and murder. Just a little price gouging. Their album Wait, the weighing on the scale kind, not the waiting in the line kind, made it to the Billboard Top 40. Henry also put out his double disc set called Get in the Van, On the Road with Black Flag, where he reads from his tour diary. And guess what? He won a fucking Grammy for it. Best Spoken Word Recording. Yeah, for just talking about shit. Where's my fucking Grammy? Huh? Grammy people? Sorry. The Recording Academy of the United States. I had to fucking look that up, by the way. Henry Rollins was even named Man of the Year by Details Magazine and also started writing for them. With all this fame, Rollins started showing up on MTV and VH1, and he even made his acting debut in this movie called The Chase, where he played a cop, which, if you've read or listened to Get in the Van, you'll know that there's some heavy irony at play there. Him playing a cop. Henry Rollins does not like the police. So it's 1995 or thereabouts. And the Rollins Band's label, Imago Records, has gone bankrupt. Henry Rollins shifted gears and just gave up on life. He sank into a deep depression. Foregoing his life of fitness and tireless drive for one of endless deep-fried delights and things dipped in cheese and sleeping 21 hours a day, waking only to cry, eat more deep-fried things dipped in cheese and lick the plates of things he ate the day before while also crying. That's nonsense, of course. No, instead he moved the fuck on, is what he did, focusing on his spoken word career. He dropped, quote, everything. That was the name of it. He dropped that in 1996. It was an audiobook version of his book, I Scream. E-Y-E, Scream, not I, as in me, but I, like eyeball. The book's called I Scream, like eyeball scream. Anyway, but it had some free-form jazz beats thrown in there with it. He also kept busy with acting gigs in movies like Heat with, you know, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. That movie, he's in that. Also, the movie Johnny Mnemonic with Keanu Reeves. He's in that movie with Keanu Reeves. And he did the movie Lost Highway, which has Marilyn Manson in it, I think. And Bill Pullman? I don't know. Lost Highway, by the way, great fucking soundtrack. The Rollins Band eventually signed with DreamWorks Records in 1997 and put out Come In and Burn. But it didn't get as much love from the critics as the earlier stuff. Rollins kept doing his spoken word thing, though, and put out Black Coffee Blues that same year. We're into 1998 now. He put out Think Tank, which was his first set of spoken material that wasn't related to a book, in 5 years. Around this time, Rollins was feeling the tug of creative stagnation with the lineup as it was in his band, so he fucking just disbanded the Rollins Band. He said, "You're fucking fired. Go find some other fucking guy to Rollins Band with, other than a Rollins." No. But he did disband the Rollins Band, being like, "Guys, we're not really going anywhere with this, are we?" So he disbanded those people. Then while working with a band from L.A. called Mother Superior, he was producing, because he does that too. He was like, "Hey, guys, want to join me and make a new Rollins Band?" And they were like, "Yeah, sure, whatever. Just fucking pay us. We're tired of working for Haagen-Dazs Dazzlers, you ice cream slinging piece of shit." And then summoning up all of his fighting skills he had learned from his years as a Haagen-Dazs manager, he beat them into submission, forced them to eat pint after pint of delicious Haagen-Dazs, and got a few records out of them. Haagen-Dazs made like no other. Oh, that lawsuit is looming, isn't it? I can see it on the horizon. No, of course, that's not what he did, obviously. So 2 years later, Rollins and his new crew released their first album called Get Some, Go Again. These album titles. They kept making more albums, like Nice in 2001 and Rise Above, 24 Black Flag songs to benefit the West Memphis 3 in 2003. Many, many more iterations of the Rollins Band would follow, including getting back together with previous members and such. Eventually, Henry would put the band on permanent hiatus. As of now, he stated that he's done with the music portion of his career. From an interview with The Guardian, he said, "One day, I woke up and thought, I'm done. My manager flipped out. But I've never looked back. I didn't want to become a human jukebox playing old songs, so I filled the space the band took with films and TV. And now my shows and my radio show and writing. At this point, I wouldn't go back on stage with the band for anything," unquote, if I didn't say that was a quote from him. But after that, Rollins got all into radio and TV stuff. In 2006, on Tom Green Live, he said he may never do music again. And in 2011, when talking to Trebuchet Magazine in an interview with Culture Brats, Henry admitted he had sworn off music for good. Quote, "sworn off music for good." And another quote here, "And I must say that I miss it every day. I just don't honestly know what I could do with it that's different," unquote. In the ensuing years, Henry Rollins tirelessly worked in almost every conceivable entertainment medium, on top of starting and running his own publishing company and record label. He's traveled and toured incessantly for decades, doing spoken word engagements all over the world. He's a prolific writer. He's authored over 30 books of various stripes, from tour diaries to poetry to photography. In 2011, he began writing a weekly column for LA Weekly. It covered a wide range of topics, often offering readers a mix of personal anecdotes, social commentary, and cultural observations. He wrote about his travels around the world, the people he met, and the unique experiences he encountered. Unfortunately, due to a change of ownership of management in 2017, that was the last year that Henry would write for LA Weekly. All the while, however, Henry doesn't stop. He's an inspirational force of fucking nature. He is the epitome of self-motivation, consistently and persistent in his determination, all attributes that I severely lack. The first time I saw Henry Rollins was, as I think I mentioned before, was with my wife, in person, I mean. And I thought, how interesting would a spoken word performance by, it'd be a nice alternate kind of entertainment to go to, you know? Not a concert or anything like that. Just seeing a guy do spoken word, you know. And if you're gonna go do a if you're gonna go check out a spoken word thing, why not have it be a famous guy, albeit not a celebrity that's all as well known as, like, say, Barack Obama, you know. Type that's roundly recognized instantly and flocked to. Though Henry Rollins still draws a crowd, obviously. He's described himself, Henry Rollins has described himself as a minor celebrity. He's still a fairly famous guy. Like I said before, he's been in multiple mainstream and B-movies and such. He's rubbed elbows with rock stars old and young, and was a rock star himself. He's traveled the world many times over, written a fuck ton of books, entertained thousands of people. The guy has been in and around active war zones too, for fuck's sake. This, of course, brings me to why we're here. The one book I have of his many books is called Before the Chop 3. And it's signed. I wasn't there when he signed it, of course, but I did buy it at that spoken word performance that I went to with my wife. So pretty badass. Plus, the book is out of print. So double badass. On a very related note, I recently went to another spoken word thing he did just not too long ago with my son. It was great, as usual. This one was different, though, in that my beautifully, wonderfully, wonderful wife bought the meet and greet VIP package thing for my son and I. So after the general audience performance, spoken word performance, we got to hang out and around Henry Rollins. We got to hang out adjacent to Henry Rollins as he talked to the VIP group for another hour or longer. We also got pictures taken with the man. And by the way, they are some of the most awkward pictures I've ever taken with anyone in my life. I didn't know what to do. I fucking didn't know what to do. I don't think, I mean, Henry Rollins was, he's a sweaty old man. What the fuck do you do with that? My arms are by my sides. I will never post those pictures anywhere. They're the most terribly awkward pictures you will ever see at two human beings in a photograph. Like, Henry Rollins had to meet me halfway. He leaned in because I look like a petrified stick of fucking, just a stick, like a fucking board. My hands are at my sides. It looks like I'm terrified with the weirdest smile on my face. I look like I might murder him later. It's terrible. And you will never see them ever. Sorry. Fucking awful. Anyway. But I did. I did get pictures taken with him. So I did that. Fucking bad pictures. But anyway. Regardless. At that spoken word thing, you get to submit a question that he may or may not answer, because he gets it's a pile of fucking questions. But during the meet and greet, and to be honest, I had a hard time coming up with a question. It's probably just me, but there's a kind of fantasy engagement that plays out anytime you imagine meeting someone famous and you have a chance to interact with them, even more so when you get to ask them a question. One element of that fantasy meeting is almost always that you will be memorable to that celebrity or whatever, and they will carry that interaction they had with you forever. That, of course, is fucking ridiculous. They fucking meet crowds of people every day. Surely, why would you stick out? Get the fuck out of here. They'll bring you up at, you know, the fantasy is that they're going to bring you up at parties and then meet other meet and greets. And they'll be like, oh man, there was this one time I met that one guy who was like a fucking board. And he was a freak. A nervous, weird freak. Anyway, it's a stupid proposition once you realize they've interacted with hundreds of thousands of people before you. The same is true of a question to ask them. What the fuck are you going to ask them they've never heard before? Every great and idiotic question under the sun has been asked of them at least 200 times. A piece. They've all been thrown at them. The older they get, the more likely it is that they've heard it. So what the hell do I do? What the hell do I bring to the table? Sure, I overthought it. But, you know, it was a nice exercise. What could I have possibly asked him that he hadn't have heard before?
How about, hey, famous writer, movie, punk singer guy, how do you reinter the spirit of a recently resurrected radio show personality? Because one that's been recently ripped from the afterlife would love to know.
I'm fairly sure he wouldn't have answered that. It's psychotic and it's...
Oh, come on! It's worth a shot, kid.
That it is, Shep. That it is. Say, did you ever think that maybe this was a prime opportunity to explore some of those ideas or concepts that you know, in this state, that you never had a chance to do when you were alive?
Oh, I never thought of it that way. If only I had some kind of long-term restful state with which to do that in, you know? Some kind of, I don't know, a long-term, almost infinite amount of time, you know? Like, whatchamacallit, an eternity, yes. Some kind of eternal period of time that I might non-work. A non-working period of time to mull over those ideas you're talking about, right? Oh, I got it, Elton. Ready? This whole thing, it just came to me. What if, follow along with me here, what if I had an eternal rest of some sort, you know? One I could really hash out all of my personal foibles then. Maybe the universe, or just the tough questions like, what is the best ice cream? Why aren't there more natural occurring blue foods? And the biggest one of all, why is the ability to raise the dead available to any nincompoop with a podcast, but putting the dead back to rest is harder than putting a man on the freaking moon using a homemade slingshot?
Ah, right. Yeah, I'm working on it, Shep. I promise. For now, I'll move on. So this book that I got from the first time I saw him with my wife didn't help me search for the best question to ask him. Not by a long shot. It's like one long, well-written reason why any question I could have thought of to ask him would have been completely lacking. This book is a testament to a life being thoroughly used and lived and made fascinating. Though how well and to what degree of satisfaction he's achieved with it is for Henry Rollins to know. Would you say a guy who chased down work nonstop for his entire life led a fulfilling life, or did he waste it? What if that work involved being a DJ while also being an actor in a movie? Should he have set up camp, made a lot of babies, and retired to an old clapboard country house or something instead? Is that more fulfilling? It's all subjective. Subjective. I have words in my face that can come out anytime they want in the right way, but they don't. So Before the Chop 3 is a collection of columns Henry Rollins wrote for the LA Weekly newspaper, magazine, whatever the LA Weekly was. It was a free weekly alternative newspaper in Los Angeles, California. The paper covers Los Angeles music, arts, film, theater, culture, concerts, and events. According to Mr. Rollins's Before the Chop 3 is articles number 201 to number 300 of his work for the LA Weekly. What makes these versions different than the ones that you see online or in print is that they are not edited or, quote, unquote, chopped for the space limitations of the print version, and they retain their original titles. To be clear, this is not new writing. It is, however, what I initially intended to put in front of the reader, unquote. Written from 2014 to 2016, the columns in the book cover a weirdly interesting time period, though it didn't seem like it at the time. It's hard to believe that what Henry wrote about back then was almost 10 years ago now. Seems like a century ago. Reading through it, it was like taking a short backwards jaunt in a time machine. He covers the Charlie Hebdo shooting, ruminating on the nature of satire because of it. Pondering whether the shooters were just opportunistic murderers looking for an excuse to kill. And how he, Henry Rollins, reacted and reacts to satire involving himself. In this case, he talks about a satirical comic book which is about Henry Rollins and Glenn Danzig being in a romantic relationship. He said that he's often asked to autograph issues of it, which he does, but he's never read it, has no interest in doing so. But that it does exist, and, you know, so what? That's a pretty healthy way to go about it, I think. It's a lot healthier than, you know, killing someone over it. Fucking assholes. He also says that he heard in the comic book, he and Glenn have Hall & Oates as neighbors, which he thinks is hilarious, but I found profoundly offensive. Basically, it's rendering any other neighborhood besides that particular one a messy, shitty pretender to the throne of great neighborhoods to live in. Hall & Oates? I'd love to live in that fucking neighborhood. Henry Rollins' writing style lends an air of intimacy to everything he writes about. It's like you're there with him. It's almost like a diary, but with like a messaging, you know? Well, sometimes anyway. The columns in the book are laid out chronologically and differ from the LA Weekly printed counterparts in that these are the unedited versions. When asked if he favored the edited columns, he said, quote, "I have never once read the edited version of any of my LA Weekly pieces. They are two different pieces of writing. One is mine. The other is the editor's. I have no doubt that he has improved the state of many, if not all, of the pieces I've submitted. I write like I write. He edits like he edits. Two different conversations. The editor changes the title of the pieces, almost every one of them I have ever seen. Usually when someone writes me and asks about it, it makes me cringe. I can only assume the editing takes the same line. This is one of the reasons we put out the Before the Chop books." End quote. A writer's relationship with an editor has always been fascinating to me. It seems like they either respect the scope of their contribution to the end result or loathe ever having to have their work cut to pieces by someone who isn't them. I've never been good enough to worry about it, but still, it's neat to get insight into a writer's process. Better still, to find yourself feeling simpatico to a celebrity you've seen for most of your life. Me, Elton, came into punk a little before my freshman year of high school, I think. I caught some band names in some magazine blurbs and heard whispers among friends or satellite acquaintances or even the older brothers and sometimes sisters of friends. I tried to remember them all. Growing up in flyover country made it a little hard to come by anything punk, you know, that wasn't readily available on the radio. At that time, Henry Rollins was in his Rollins Band phase, so he would pop up fairly regularly. I can say it. He used to pop up fairly regularly in my teenage zeitgeist. I was a hybrid metalhead / punk / grunge alternative kid, or at least I tried to be. I wanted to work my way back through the sources of, you know, the people, my heroes at the time, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, all of those. One of them that kept popping up was Black Flag. Henry Rollins was a bulky, tatted vet of a band I wanted a way into. It wasn't until later that I learned about his book, Get in the Van, about his time with Black Flag, or even his spoken word stuff, which I just found out he started doing right after, if not during, the last days of his time in Black Flag. He started doing it way back in the 80s. And I read this online somewhere. He started doing spoken word performances, after a promoter heard him talking to fans after a show. When Henry was done and going to leave, the promoter asked if he could do that talking thing again for 10 more minutes. And he said, sure. for $10. So the guy paid him $10. And he went on for 10 more minutes. Afterward, people were asking him when he was going to do it again. And he said, when I get 10 more dollars. But that'll have to be later, because I'm taking the 10 I got and going to eat for the first time in a week. That sounds about right, considering how poverty-stricken he's described his time with Black Flag. Not eating for a week seems about par for the course. So I guess I stumbled onto his work in a way that was, I was playing catch-up. He was a singer, radio DJ, a writer, a spoken word performer slash artist, a publishing company owner, a record label owner, TV show host, interviewer. Good God, you could go on for days with what he's done, what he's currently doing, and you'd probably still miss something. I've always kind of liked Henry Rollins. He seemed to be kind of like the guy with good stories to tell, you know, so you wanted to hang around him. You know, he'd always be up for diverse stuff, like hitting up a bar or an art exhibit, you know, sometimes in the same night. But you'd also kind of be afraid he'd beat your ass, like you were a Haagen-Dazs customer that ordered the wrong flavor, you know. So, when reading my way through the book, that was nonsense, I'm sorry. So when I was reading my way through the book, it was like having Henry Rollins as your tour guide through his life. That's weird. That's really weird to say, but it's how it read to me. He talks about the news items of the day or some weird life event he was involved in that at that time, while also suggesting music and delivering some social commentary all at the same time in the same column. Take, for instance, his column from August 13th, 2015, titled Of Time and River 2. In it, he writes about his odd fascination with rivers. Then he goes on to describe the many rivers he's encountered throughout his life. He starts with growing up on the Potomac, then hits on the ideas of the LA River being a metaphor for an outsider's perspective of Los Angeles. Examples of limitless wealth and effortless glamour are everywhere except where you live, you know? And he talks about seeing the Nile River for the first time and the Ganges. It's a beautiful little trip. In another column, not too far from that one, I found one of the most unintentionally deep and inspirational lines in the book. Well, for me anyway. And it's only part of a sentence, but I thought it was pretty brilliant. He's talking about biodiversity in relation to his trip on the Napo River, which is a tributary of the Amazon. The full quote is, quote, "A frenzy of life will ensue in the vacancies created almost immediately." That first part, though, "a frenzy of life will ensue in the vacancies," that jumped out to me. It's like a key to part of what Henry Rollins is. He strives to constantly keep busy, like an empty space will quickly be filled with meaningless stuff. That line seemed very insightful to my own life, or time, or whatever, too. It spoke to me as if to say, if you take too long of a beat with something, anything, life will jump into that void and fill that gap. Putting something off today gives the calamity of the everyday an opportunity to fill up that gap and keep kicking the can down the road. Fucking damn it, Henry Rollins. He's inadvertently right, right? I mean, that's what happens if you let it or allow it to happen. It happens to me all the time. I get in my own head about something, anything, this podcast, and then there's a gap. And then just like recently, life fills it and the podcast waits. And it keeps waiting, and time passes, while a frenzy of life ensues in the vacancy. Damn it. He's a smart guy, even if he didn't mean it that way. Inadvertent message received, Mr. Henry Rollins. Less diversion, more focus. Time will steamroll you while you're fidgeting about with content. Even if he wasn't explicit in saying that, I think he would get it. Henry, if you're listening to this, first, thank you. Second, send an email to eltonreadsabookaweek@gmail.com and let me know how far off the map I am. What am I doing? Ah, but Mr. Rollins has a warning about being prolific, which he undoubtedly is. He says in another column that if you go about making something creative and putting it out into the world, it never really goes away. It's always there, and people will always ask about it. You carry it and will carry it with you always. He created so much stuff that, as he puts it, it's a heavier weight than he ever imagined. Quote, you don't get to break up with an album or a film, he says. I have yet to enjoy that rarefied experience. I mean, I've written some stuff over the years, weird comedy articles, scripts, videos, I think. I even drew a webcomic that exists somewhere out there on the internet somewhere. Still, to be asked about something I created years after I made it, as though it was still a thing, fuck, that would be, for me, pretty cool. Henry, of course, has had this experience most of his adult life. He's got a great insider perspective. I can respect that. His advice on this point is well heeded, too. More or less, he makes a point, or a couple of points in the same article saying, well, I'm paraphrasing. He says, learn to let go by getting help with what you do. Also, don't be a dick to people that help. You'll run into them later, and they'll remember your cockface attitude. So don't fuck it up. If you create and produce it, it becomes a tangible part of your past. A past that you'll carry for the rest of your days. How fucking deep is that? Even paraphrased by my poorly worded ass. The idea is solid. Fucking Henry Rollins, man. He's amazing. This particular Before the Chop, the third one that I have, is currently out of print. But the others are still on Amazon. And you can probably find this one on eBay somewhere. Still. I'll link to one of the other ones. My tongue is giving up on me. I'll link to one of the other ones. There it goes again. I'll link to one of the other ones in the description. But this book is fantastic, and I'm sure they are too. I learned a lot from it. There's a lot to get out of it. I've been looking up the different bands he mentions in it, different concerts he talks about. Lots and lots of rabbit holes to be explored just because of this book. You should get one. It's a gateway to a larger world, believe me.
Speaking of gateways, the gateway to the hereafter was terrifying. It was terrifying, yet comforting all at the same time. Kind of like being nervous of what your parents would say after being away from home for a long time. You weren't sure you would be welcome, but you just knew that you would be, you know? Oh, and it was filled with light, that gateway. It was this kind of luminescent bright white, all-encompassing glow it was. Though it was also kind of a golden light, too. It's so hard to explain. Gosh, it was so bright, so very intense. But you know what? It didn't hurt your eyes, you know? You could look right into it and know that there was nothing to be afraid of. Oh, and there were all of these, what I can only describe as shimmering twinkles, gently falling like snow. Oh, in trying to figure out what they were, I've come to imagine they were little bits of heaven. They were suspended in the light for a while before floating down and down like an indescribably wonderful dream. Golly, it was just fantastic. Oh, and then amid the ambient choral singing that seemed to envelop you like a warm embrace, probably the voices of angels, amid all of that, a voice rose up above it, booming over everything.
What did the voice say?
It bellowed, "Show's over, Shep. You're being recalled back to the earthly realm because some pud-pulling dingus needs an interview for his podcast or some other such ridiculous nonsense."
No, come on. You passed away a long time ago. You didn't just arrive there standing at the gate when I did that episode, right?
All right. Maybe not, but come on already. I would like to try resting in peace for a change, Elton. This This hanging around in a weird limbo internet void place. Or it doesn't matter. It's not great for the soul, kid. Or at least I don't think it is. Who knows?
I know,
it's
man.
It's just not right.
I know. I'll admit, I've been slacking on it. A lot on it, all right? A lot of things. I've been slacking on a lot of things, okay, Shep? I just feel like I don't know what I'm doing. And then I cinch up and call myself a failure, right. And then I stall out.
Sure.
And I'm not moving forward.
I do, but,
I try to do everything at once,
you
know, to try and catch up, right?
Listen,
I'm handicapping
really,
myself by burying myself alive.
Yep.
But you know what?
Lots of people
I'm making
feel
a change.
Like that sometimes,
a change
but you just have
in
to,
myself.
Well, you can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to catch
I mean, I know I've said it before,
once,
and I know that.
And
it's almost impossible to change your
work.
Entire approach to life and habits and shit.
Oh.
But Henry Rollins spoke to me, man.
Good,
he
Elton.
Spoke
change
to me, Shep. He fills every moment with
fills every moment.
Totally efficient action. Not a minute wasted.
Not wasting
you know?
A minute?
He's
that
not
seems to be a little
inflating the importance of using cologne as a life-altering decision or listening to
life
Paul
altering.
Simon's entire
that
discography,
any,
which I still have to do.
Look, I don't
and
know if I'm the right...
saying somehow it's improving himself. He knows the score,
no,
man. He knows when he's bullshitting himself.
That,
and he would know that I am. For sure.
Sure.
You
sure.
know?
Yeah, wait, now...
But
I
said before...
Again, I was saying,
about...
But, yeah?
Paul
oh,
Simon's...
Okay.
Discography not being a life altering
about,
or whatever.
I mean, I've heard of Paul Simon.
I mean, have you heard the song Dear Lorraine, Shep?
Whether his songs
it's like he gave up
anything.
On lyrics that day. Seriously. So I walked right up to her, and with the part of me that talks, I introduced myself as Frank. I mean, what the fuck is that, Shep? The part that talks? Did Paul forget what a fucking mouth was that day? It's like your weird middle-aged drunk uncle showed up with a guitar and put his dead
Elton,
marriage
kid,
to music.
You seem to have gone off into the
now,
weeds.
Now, am
of,
I a more productive
well,
person?
Who the hell knows where?
Because I sat through
productive?
Paul Simon's brain
wow,
fart.
I'm just
Henry Rollins
let you
knows
vent,
I'm not.
Or
he'd be on a plane to Quinto,
epiphany,
Ecuador,
maybe?
You know, to
if,
almost get stabbed in an alley in the morning,
is, okay?
And then
just
watch river dolphins fuck
to, okay,
in the afternoon. That guy is filling his life every minute with stuff. Productive
right.
as fuck is what he is. I'm sitting here listening to Paul Simon
sure,
phone
are.
In lyrics like all my life I've been a wanderer. Not really. I mostly lived near my parents' home. Anyway, Lorraine, I got married and the usual marriage stuff. The usual marriage stuff? Paul? God damn it, Shep. What am I doing?
You seem to be having a breakdown, kid, though it seems
I'll tell you what
positive.
I'm doing, Shep. I'm Henry Rollins-ing, I'm Henry Rollins-ing my life. I'm amping up production, and I'm getting shit done. I'm going to find that guy who gave us the incantation to raise you from the dead, and I'm going to demand the opposite thing. The antidote spell thing, Shep, to send you back to hell where you came from.
Whoa, hey there, pal. I didn't go to...
I know, Shep, sorry. I got on a roll. It's just, I got really excited, you know, to get a jump start on filling my days with efficiency, with efficient, productive production. You know, I'm officially committing myself to getting everything done, damn it. This Henry Rollins book, it's fucking motivational. I'm doing this shit, Shep.
That's great, kid. I'm glad you're taking the old bull by the horns, and I thank you in advance for tracking down the spell or whatever.
Thank you.
Thank you. Finally.
I'm going to get this done. Everything done, Shep. I'm going to push myself to get to annihilate every obstacle in my path, man. You know, I'm really going to do it.
I like where your head's at, kid. I do. But, you know, it kind of sounds like maybe you're just taking too much on again, though. Maybe.
Yes. Yes, I'm going to assert myself into my own life. Insert?
No. That's not
whatever.
What I meant.
I'm doing it, Shep. Things have been slipping, and just I just procrastinated myself into paralysis. No more.
Well,
I need to get this podcast
this is,
out more regularly. I need to fix the house, get all of the books organized, insulate the kitchen.
It's too much all at once.
You know?
You're going to overwhelm yourself and be right back where you started.
More.
See,
I need to stop beating myself up with insecurity and get this where I want it to be, Shep.
gosh, that sounds like an awful lot, Elton. Maybe you should do something practical first, like make a list or something, a list of priorities, you know? Maybe tackle one thing at a time, you know? Start
what?
With just getting
Come
organized.
Come on, Shep. After reading this book, it's given me a different way to look at my limited time on Earth. I have to strike while the iron is hot. I have to fill every moment, Shep. I'm going to fix up the house. Should I buy stuff? I need to finish the attic now? Or, damn it. No, I'm putting up that bookshelf, too. Then finish the attic. Oh, I have to buy wood. Insulate the attic. Reshingle the roof. I've got to go. I've got to start now. Shep, every second counts.
I'm glad you finally got that fire burning
wood,
for yourself there, Elton. Still, it sounds a little like you're just repeating it seems like you're repeating the same pattern is what I'm trying to say, you know? Did you leave? Hello? Elton? Hey, maybe you should come back and wrap up this episode first before you go and do whatever with Paul Simon and your roof. Elton? Hello? Well? Crap.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Elton Reads Book a Week. If you like what you heard and want to help get it produced on the regular, you know, please consider contributing via the podcast Patreon page. You can also talk to me directly over there, you know, and listen to extra stuff, notes, and all kinds of crap. If you're not able to contribute, please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on Apple or Google or any of the other places. Though I don't know if Google's going to be around anymore or for much longer. Or any place you get the podcast, really. Rating and reviewing, it really helps. It also helps to share the podcast, maybe on Facebook or wherever in the hell. And you can follow all the social media stuff, too. I have a LinkedIn thing. Am I itching my head? You can probably fucking hear that. Word of mouth is a great way to help the podcast grow. So follow it on all the social media stuff, the Facebook and the Instagram and all that. It's everywhere, I'm pretty sure. If not, email me at Elton Reads a Book a Week and let me know. EltonReadsABookAWeek@gmail.com. You know, let me know where it's not or where it is and that you, I don't know. Email me. Above all else, I just appreciate the time you took to listen to this. I really appreciate it. Oh, and if you wouldn't mind, could you maybe start reading a book this week? Hit up a library. Join a book. Join a book. Don't waste time. Henry Rollins Up Your Life. Buy a book at a grocery store, wherever you fancy. Don't let them die out, huh? Thank you. Thanks again. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Crap in a hat.